Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Anthony Southall. I'm on Michael Green's list. I'm a member of the Inner Bar and have practised in the field of probate and administration of deceased estates for many years. Welcome to another very powerful and very practical probate update presented by Michael Green's list B. Two very relevant topics are being covered today, and both relate to recent important decisions of the Victorian Supreme Court. Our two presenters are Alefteria Constantinou and Jeremy Smith. I'll say more about their respective qualifications and presentations in a moment, but going firstly to the issue, Terry will be going first, that is Terry Constantinou. Her presentation will cover what is at first blush a broad topic, the powers and duties of executors, but she will be relating it to particular situations, in particular the specific settlement of litigation by an executor on behalf of an estate, and even more specifically, settlement of Part 4 litigation. I'm sure you've all been involved in a Part 4 litigation where the issue has arisen as to actually what power does an executor have to compromise the litigation when one or other existing beneficiaries don't agree with that. And Terry will cover the issue of how far an executor can go and what the executor's duties towards protecting the estate against unnecessary and prolonged expensive litigation, and on the other hand, upholding the primary duty of upholding the will of the deceased. It's always an issue, it'll always arise, and nowadays with mediation and settlements occurring before litigation, it's of even greater relevance. She'll be addressing her paper particularly in the light of Justice McMillan's recent decision in Hodge and De Pasquale, which really to some extent covers the field on the issues that Terry will address, but she'll be doing so with a particular spin on that decision and its impact for the future conduct of litigation, particularly in the context of the duty of solicitors. Terry was admitted to the bar in 2002, November 2002, so she's now a well-established and well-accredited member of the bar. She was admitted to practice 5 years before that in November 97. She is a regular attender and indeed presenter at these probate and estate presentations. And indeed, she also presents on the Television Education Network, TEN. I thought for a moment that it meant Channel 10, but it's TEN. And she does that in the context of probate and wills litigation also. So she does have a fair provenance in the field. She does a lot of work in the area, naturally, not only Part 4, but in Rule 54 applications to the Supreme Court for variations of wills for seeking questions for determination by the court, an important provision, I should say, Order 54. Read it and remember it because it's the basis of a lot of applications to the court in this field. She's also an accredited mediator, gained her accreditation with the Leader Mediation Group, LEADR Mediation Group, in 2004, so she's been at it in terms of that accreditation for 10 years, and more recently in June of last year she gained an additional national accreditation as a mediator under the NMAS scheme. So I'd ask you to welcome Terry to the lectern and listen with interest to her very interesting paper. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony. I have to congratulate you on the pronouncement of my first name so early in the morning. That was very, very well done. So yes, the duties of executors when settling Part 4 claims. I mean, how many times have we come across a situation where we've finished a very difficult mediation, estate mediation, which has probably started at 10 and finished at 7 o'clock in the evening. We're all tired, we're all hungry, and we're all exhausted from the day's proceedings. We've entered into terms of settlement that we think are going to stand, and you have a beneficiary, a residuary beneficiary, that wasn't part of the terms, didn't attend the mediation, wasn't involved in the litigation, and now wants to overturn those terms of settlement. What do we do? The opening words, in fact, if I can just have Justice McMillan's decision. The opening statement of Her Honour's decision in Hodge and DePasquale says it all, and I'll read it. This proceeding concerns the power of the executor of an estate to settle a claim made under Part 4 of the Administration Probate Act. Although it concerns an issue that would arise on a regular basis, both in this jurisdiction and in others, as far as I'm aware, it is the first time that the relevant powers have been considered. And that is the truth. It is the first time that the relevant powers have been considered. Her Honour was interested during, after the conclusion of the trial. Her Honour raised two significant questions that she wished the parties to address her on, and that was in particular the operation of section 19 subsection 1 paragraph F of the Trustee Act. I have extracted it in my paper, but the two questions she asked the parties to address her on were these. Does section 19 of the Trustee Act provide an executor with the power to give effect to a compromise by making further provision from the estate for the proper maintenance and support of a person to whom the deceased had a responsibility to provide? So does Section 19 provide an executive with the power to do that? And if not, what is the source of the executor's power to make such provision? In short, Her Honour said that the executor partly has power and partly doesn't, and I'll explain why. But the facts are important, and I'll just briefly go through them. In Hodge versus DePasquale, the estate was worth just over $4.5 million. There were three daughters and one stepmother. The stepmother was the executrix. Stepmum got the matrimonial home by survivorship, and she also got investment property in Rye. One daughter, Eleonora, got a real estate in Thornbury worth $1.5 million. Pia, who was the plaintiff in the Part 4 proceeding, got a block of 10 flats worth $2.1 million. There was a condition precedent to her taking that gift, and that was that she was to repay back to the estate a loan of money that she got from her father during his lifetime. That condition was satisfied. The block of flats went to her. Norina Hodge got a lump sum payment of $500,000, or such lesser amount after the estate's debts and testamentary expenses were accounted for. So it wasn't a fixed sum. It was a sum that was to be paid to her under the will if there was enough money in the estate to pay her that amount. That's an important and critical fact. Norina lived in America. All the other daughters, the two other daughters were here. Pia made a Part 4 claim. Norina and Eleonora, the two daughters, were advised of the Part 4 claim, and they were encouraged to put in any affidavits in opposition. Eleonora did put an affidavit in opposition. She was also represented by lawyers. Norina was also represented by lawyers, but she chose not to become involved, and she didn't file any material. The matter went through the usual processes and went to mediation. Norina was advised that the mediation was going to take place, the date, the time and the venue. She was encouraged to attend with or without a lawyer. She didn't attend. In fact, it transpired that she was in the country on the day of the mediation, but she just didn't attend the mediation. She did, through her solicitors, though, make it clear to the estate that if her, at any time, if her entitlement to the $500,000 was to be affected in any way, that she was to be advised immediately. That was another critical point. She put it in writing through her solicitors. I'm not attending, but if my $500,000 is going to be affected by any settlement, I want to know about it. So the mediation takes place and it yielded a settlement. Terms of settlement were executed between Pia and Rosa. Under those terms, Pia got an additional $250,000 payable in two installments, $100,000 and $150,000. What was critical about that term was that there was no indication in the terms of settlement, and nor was it discussed at mediation, from where that settlement sum was to come from. What part of the estate was going to bear the $250,000 settlement sum? It was just a sum of money. Didn't know where it was going to come from. And that was also very critical. Counsel for the estate gave advice on the merits of the terms and of the settling of the proceeding. And that was the subject of some scrutiny by Her Honour in the decision. And there are extracts of the advice in Her Honour's decision. I won't read it, but it's there for you to read it in due course. The nub of the advice was that because Norina's entitlement was in a sense a contingent entitlement, if there was enough money in the estate, she would get the 500. Because that was contingent, it wasn't a fixed sum, there was nothing wrong with the estate taking the $250,000 settlement sum from Norina's share entirely, 100%. Eleonora and Norina were advised, Eleonora was at the mediation, Norina was advised of the terms of settlement, and not surprisingly, that precipitated a flurry of correspondence between the estate solicitors and Norina's solicitors. Norina, not surprisingly, disputed the terms. She disputed the terms on the grounds that they were entered into without her consent, and she didn't consent to the settlement sum being paid out of her share. So the usual threats were made, don't pay the settlement sum. Threats of injunctions were made. The estate solicitors were advised that the settlement sum could not be paid because Norina was going to challenge it. And the estate solicitors held Pia's solicitors held the estate to the terms, threatening to sue for breach of contract if they didn't follow through. Norina then commenced the proceedings to challenge the terms. The questions for the court were these. Was Rosa acting outside of her powers as the executrix, and was she in breach of her duties by entering into the terms without obtaining the consent of Norina? Is Pia liable to repay the settlement sum? And if Pia is not liable to repay that, is Rosa indemnified from the estate for the settlement sum? And then we had those further questions pursuant to Section 19 of the Trustee Act and whether how that operated and whether that gave Rosa power to compromise the Part 4 claim. Norina argued that the executrix was ultra vires. She argued that she had no power under Section 19, and Section 19 did not operate to give her a power to vary the beneficial interests of Norina under the will. What Section 19 of the Trustee Act does is it gives executors powers to compromise a claim on the estate, but Narina argued it does not go far enough to vary those beneficial interests without the consent of the affected beneficiary. So in effect, there was no power for Rosa to compromise the claim, either one, without Narina's consent, or two, without getting the approval of the court. Rosa argued that she did have the power to settle the Part 4 claim, and although she could have sought the approval of the court, she didn't need to. And she didn't need to because she had the power, she is the ultimate upholder of the will, and if, in her opinion, it was a commercial decision to resolve the Part 4 claim and avoid the estate in incurring significant legal costs and going to trial, then it was her duty as a litigant to settle the claim. So she had the power. She also argued there was no impropriety in the exercise of that power. She did nothing wrong. She argued that she did it in good faith. And she also argued that she properly considered the commercial realities of settling, and she had legal advice. Now, Pia argued that Section 19 of the Trustee Act did expressly confer power on the executor and trustee to compromise the Part 4 claim, because that was a broad power that was expressly stated in the section. So you couldn't argue that she didn't have the power, but you could argue about how she exercised it. And that's where Pia argued. She said that, in other words, if it was exercised in good faith, then there should be no problem with that. So she was in line with the executor's arguments in that regard. Now, what did Her Honour hold? Her Honour ultimately held that consent was required from Narina and or approval of the court before the settlement could be finally discharged. There's a very interesting discussion by Her Honour about the powers of trustees generally to compromise claims on the estate. There's much discussion of the English Court of Appeal decision in Earl of Strafford, and that concerned a question about whether or not a beneficiary was entitled to a particular asset. It didn't concern the question or it didn't concern the issue of a variation of beneficial interests under a trust or a will. So that was a distinguishing factor. Where there is a variation of a beneficiary's interest under a will that affects their entitlements, it is incumbent on the executor to seek their approval before entering into a compromise. And if they can't get it, you go to the Order 54 procedure and you get the approval of the court. So Her Honour distinguished that English Court of Appeal decision in that regard. There's only one decision in this state that considers Section 19 of the Trustee Act, and that's Justice Nettle's decision in Dowling versus St Vincent de Paul. And some thought is given to His Honour's decision by Her Honour in this case, and in fact Her Honour quite rightly followed his decision. Her Honour also found that even though there were broad powers for executors to compromise a claim, and even though Section 19 does expressly confer power on executors and trustees to compromise claims, it does not go as far enough as to allow them to vary those beneficial interests. So this is the critical factor. You can settle, if you're acting for an estate, you can compromise claims on the estate and make commercial decisions to settle things. But if the effect of your compromise is to significantly or insignificantly, it doesn't matter, if it's to vary the beneficial interests of beneficiaries under a will or a trust, then you simply just can't do it because you think it's in the interests of the estate. You can't do it because, and even if it is a commercial decision to make and it is the best compromise that you can reach, if you don't have the consent of that beneficiary, you can't settle it. Um, I've extracted on page 11 of my paper the relevant quotes from Her Honour dealing with section 19. And they're pretty significant. I will read them out because they do just sum up the law in this area quite beautifully. She says at paragraph 77 that the trustee may settle a claim under part 4, but they must then seek orders of the court giving effect to that settlement under the relevant provision. Of course, if all the beneficiaries consent to the terms of settlement, then they may vary the trust without court order, because they retain that power. If there's consent, that's no problem. Without their consent, a trustee does not have that power and cannot give effect to an agreement to do so. In other words, you don't have the power to vary a trust or a will without the consent of the beneficiary. Now, Her Honour was fortified in her conclusions by Justice Nettle's decision in Dowling, and she said this, that the purpose of the legislation is served by allowing trustees to compromise and agree to seek orders by consent. But it is exceeded by reading into the provision, this is the Section 19 provision, a power to alter the terms of the trust by agreement with a third party. And what Her Honour said was, if an executor or trustee can do that without getting the approval of the court, then why do we have Order 54? We wouldn't need to go to court to sanction any settlement. The executor and trustee could do whatever they felt was in the interests of the will or the estate, and there wouldn't be any need for an Order 54 procedure. There wouldn't be any need for a court to sanction anything. The court would effectively be ousted of its powers to oversee the administration of a trust or a will, and that could not and is not the intention of Parliament. She says at paragraph 80, I consider the effect of the first and second defendant's submissions on this issue, if correct, would have the remarkable result of granting the power to make further provision under part 4 to trustees, a power expressly reserved by the legislature to a court, and that any such decision to make further provision would be unappealable, provided the trustee acted bona fide. And then, of course, Her Honour says that cannot be the case. Even this court is subject to appeal in ordering further provision. So there we have it. The effect of these conclusions in understanding what the powers of an executor are in compromising Part 4 claims in particular, and Part 4 claims in particular are relevant in this context because they do vary the beneficial interests of beneficiaries under a will and a trust. But the effect of what Her Honour's conclusions are, and this goes back to her partly yes and partly no answer, is that yes, an executor has the power to compromise. Those powers are broad, but they are limited, and they are limited by the need to seek consent where there is a variation of beneficial interest under a will or a trust, seek consent of that beneficiary, and if you can't get it, go to the court and get the sanction of the court. Rosa sought to argue an alternative argument, and that was that the payment of the settlement sum is characterised as a debt or a liability to the estate. And the purpose of that argument was that Rosa sought to sanction the settlement by reference to the regime in Section 39 of the Administration Probate Act that deals with the priority of payments for debts and liabilities of the estate. So Rosa argued, if I'm wrong and I didn't have the power, I could do it anyway because it was a debt, the settlement sum was a debt or a liability to the estate, and under Section 39, I was entitled to take that out of the residuary. There was no authority cited for that proposition because there isn't any authority for that proposition. A settlement sum is not a debt or liability to the estate. A settlement sum is a further provision. It's varying the beneficial interests of the beneficiary under the will. It's not a liability or a debt. Her Honour was not convinced by that argument, and that argument failed. So, what about Pia? Was she liable to repay the settlement sum back to the estate? It was alleged against Pia that she knew the settlement sum was going to be paid out of Narina's share. She knew because she should have known, was basically the argument. There was no evidence that Pia actually had knowledge that Rosa was intending to take the money from Narina's share entirely. It was put against her that she ought to have known, because where else was the money going to come from? The answer to that question was the money could have come from the sale of the Rye property, that was the investment property that Rosa got under the will. She could have taken a mortgage to pay the amount out. There were other options. It didn't have to come from Narina's share. Even though it was an application commenced by originating motion, the effect of Narina's claim against Pia in this context was a Barnes and Addy claim that she knowingly received trust money and colluded with the executrix in that process. And there was no evidence to suggest at all that that Pia had any knowledge. In any event, to allege that she had that knowledge would have been quite difficult because it wasn't discussed in the mediation. There was no indication at all from Rosa that she was intending to do this. And as far as Pia was concerned, the executrix makes the decision. She got a sum of money under the terms of settlement. She didn't care where it came from. As long as she got it, that was all that she was concerned about. Wind it up. So the final point was the whole good faith argument, and what Her Honour found was that it wasn't enough for executor to argue that she acted in good faith, and it wasn't enough to say I had legal advice, because of course an executor is always going to say that she acted in good faith, and of course an executor is always going to rely on legal advice given to her. It was incumbent on her to, knowing that Narina did not consent to these terms, regardless of the advice that she got, and regardless about her own subjective views about acting honestly and in good faith, it was still incumbent on her to obtain the order of the court or get Narina's consent. So what are the practice points? Practice points for acting for executors. I think I've made it perfectly clear. If you don't have consent in writing from all the beneficiaries, it would be prudent to get consent in writing from the beneficiaries. If they give you all-encompassing authority to do whatever you think is in the best interest of the estate, I think we can say that we're fairly safe, although I would still, in that circumstance, apply for an order for the court to approve the compromise. And if you're acting for a beneficiary and your instructions are not to get involved in the litigation, put it in writing. Let the executor know what the limits of their authority is. And I think it was very critical in this point that Narina made it very clear. If my entitlements are going to be affected, I need to know. And so in that sense, Rosa was on notice from day one and should have taken those extra steps to protect the estate. So not only was she not indemnified, Rosa had to pay back the $250,000 out of her own pocket back into the estate. She was not indemnified from the assets of the trust because she did not act properly, and Section 19 did not operate to protect her in that regard. But she was also slugged for the costs of the proceeding as well because she did not act in good faith in that regard. So it was a very much a lose-lose situation for the executor in that position, and a stark reminder to all of us that we need to be extra vigilant when settling our Part 4 claims, no matter how late in the day it is. Thank you all for your attention.
Thank you, Terry.
If I can just put in my two penneth, that's a significant case. Not only the result, but the factual matrix which underlay that case, from my perspective, it demonstrates a number of things. The first is the pitfalls of mediation, specifically the pitfalls of mediation where one party to the litigation, where it's a multi-headed party litigation, refuses to participate and makes their position clear, as the sister did in the letter. She was clearly playing some tricks. She'd come back from America and was in the country but refused to go to the mediation. That is red lights, particularly in an estate worth $4.5 million. There are flashing red lights. The buzzword is mediation. It's great in many cases. There are some cases that must go to trial. Now, whether it's trial by getting a consent of a court under Rule 54, that's still a day in court, in the Supreme Court. But it seemed that case was fairly straightforward. I haven't read it. I've read your summary of it. $4.5 million. One sister wants more out of a part four, understandably. No difficult trust issues or interpretations of a will. One day in court on a part four. Equity, as Bill Gillard once said, part fours are equity running down. They're not complex unless they're attended with other issues such as the interpretation of a will or in some cases in requiring extensive cross-examination on diaries. I'm looking at my instructing solicitor in one of the cases that I think caused the rewriting of the Act, of Part 4 of the Act. That was a case that went for almost 7 days. That had to run. But you should be aware that if you go to a mediation in these circumstances and don't mediate till 7 o'clock, no mediation should go beyond normal business hours. If it starts at 9, it finishes at probably 4:30 or 5. Parties get frazzled and it leads to problems. If it gets to 7 or 8 o'clock, not only the parties but the practitioners become frazzled. If it doesn't settle within that time, it won't settle, or at least it could settle the following day or the following month by sensible negotiations between solicitors. But this sort of hot tub pressurised mediation, as appears to have occurred in this case, leading to a ridiculous result, improperly prepared terms. It should be avoided at all costs. Otherwise, you can just march straight into the indemnity insurer's office and say, look, this is the situation.
Sorry to interrupt you, but if there was approval sought by the court to sanction these terms of settlement, Narina would have objected and the terms wouldn't have been upheld and would have been back to square one and would have run a part four claim.
Lost all that time and money.
Yeah.
Just a factual question, sorry. Just with Pia, was she aware that Narina had said, you know, had written the solicitor's letter about those
two? No, not about let me know if my entitlements is going to be. Because that was between, Narina sent the letter to the executive.
Shouldn't have that been?
And the executive didn't pass any
good question.
To the
would
question.
Have thought that would have been an obvious
one question. Would have thought so, yeah.
We can't settle
Narina's
consent.
Yes.
So obvious.
So the terms should have been made conditional upon Narina's consent or approval of the court.
And that should have been discussed.
That should have been discussed at the outset.
Yeah. It was a case, sound as though it was, as soon as that mediation was underway, it was doomed at that point. But I don't want to be too cataclysmic in that regard. Now, look, we're intruding into Jeremy Smith's time. Jeremy Smith's our next speaker. He's dealing with the well-known forfeiture rule. It's been around for many years, for many hundreds of years. Generally, the rule where a beneficiary will be disbarred from taking, or may be disbarred from taking, if involved in the unlawful death of the testator or testatrix. It's been the subject of many decisions over the years, but the interesting thing that Jeremy will address is the tension between the two essential lines of authority, and they're easy to identify. One says you take the moral view, and if you cause the death of the testator in unlawful or criminal circumstances, that's it. no benefit. That's the view of the very eminent member of the New South Wales Court of Appeal, I think Marnie, Mr Justice, is it Marnie, Jeremy? Yeah, great judge. And the amusing thing about that is that previously a good friend of mine, John Coldry, who was one of the great criminal barristers of the Melbourne Bar, not a great probate barrister, he was very proud of the fact that this, I think, was his first probate case, and it was well written. The only thing is that I think it was Des Marty. Justice Ma said he was completely and utterly wrong. But he wasn't the only one who was utterly wrong. There was a couple of others, including my other old mate, Howard Nathan, who's never either not been professed to be a great probate or equity lawyer. I think it's Justice Maher of the Court of Appeal of New South Wales whose view prevails at the present time. But Jeremy Smith will take you through that in greater and more erudite detail.